Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
My name is Rosemary Graham. I am a resident of Berkeley, California. I teach at St. Mary's College of California. I saw one of my students out there. You cannot hear. Thank you very much. I would like to welcome our guests. We have with us this morning Liz Nugent, Emer McBride, and David Hayden. All have Irish origins, Irish roots. David and Emer have come to us from England today, and Liz has come from Dublin. I'm just going to, I'll give you a very brief introduction and let them introduce themselves. Emer McBride is the author of A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing and The Lesser Bohemians, works which have been recognized for their bold experimental style and won many prizes and accolades. David Hayden's innovative lyrical short stories have appeared widely in literary magazines, including Gorse, The Moth, and The Stinging Fly. His first collection of short stories, of short fiction, is out in the UK and about to be published here in the US by Transit Press, which is a wonderful Oakland press. His publisher is here with us in the audience today. And Liz Nugent is the author of 3 novels. The most recent is called Skin Deep. I was getting mixed up with Lying in Wait. Skin Deep has just come out in Ireland, and Unraveling Oliver is available in the US, and Skin Deep is coming out later. Lying in Wait, sorry, okay. Authors, read us a little bit of your work, and then we'll start talking.
This is from the opening of Unraveling Oliver. And this is the eponymous Oliver speaking. I expected more of a reaction the first time I hit her. She just lay on the floor, holding her jaw, staring at me, silent. She didn't even seem to be surprised. I was surprised. I hadn't planned to do it. Usually, when you hear about this kind of thing, it is the 1950s, and the husband comes home to his slovenly wife from the pub and finds that his dinner is cold. But now, here she lay, the lower half of her body nearly hidden behind the legs of our mahogany dining table, her arms, head, and torso curled inward like a question mark. How had she fallen into that shape? There must have been considerable force behind my closed fist. If the glass had been in my hand, would I have stopped and put it down before I hit her? Or would I have smashed it into her face? Would it have shattered on contact and torn her pale skin? Could I have scarred her for life? It's very hard to know. The words that come to mind are circumstances beyond our control. I emphasize the word our because, although I should not have done it, she really should not have provoked me. Yeah, he's lovely.
I'm going to just read you a short little bit from A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, from about halfway through the book. I met a man. Oh, there's a sensing a theme coming on here. I met a man. I let him throw me around the bed and smoked me spliffs and choked my neck until I said I was dead. I met a man who took me for walks, long ones in the country. I offer up in the hedge. I met a man I met with her, she and me and his friend, to bars at night and drink champagne and bought me chips at every tea time. I met a man with condoms in his pockets. Don't use them. He loves children in his heart. No. I met a man who knew me once, who saw me around when I was a child, who said, "You're a fine-looking woman now," who said, "Come back, marry me, live on my farm." No. I met a man who was a priest. I did. Just as well, and many another one did. I met a man, who said he'd pay me by the month, who said he'd keep me up in style and I'd be waiting when he arrived. No, is what I say. I met a man who hit me a smack. I met a man who cracked my arm. I met a man who said, "What are you doing out so late at night?" I met a man, and wash my mouth out with soap. I wish I could, that I did then. I met a man, a stupid thing. I met a man, should have turned on my heel. I thought, I didn't know to think. I didn't even know to speak. I met a man, I kept on walking. I met a man, and I lay down, and slapped and cried and whined and dined. I met a man, and many more, and I didn't know you at all.
I was going to read something funny that involves a cigar-smoking squirrel called Sorry, but I think I probably just need to keep the theme. This is from a fairy tale called Lacedaemon of the Golden Hand. My name is Lacedaemon, and this is how my children killed me. I was lying on the floor in my overcoat, drunk and raging, when my daughter, Leota, appeared from the shadows beside the fireplace and tossed a bucket of white ashes into my face. I was blinded. She shouted, "And a dam, and a dam." I scooped the muck from my eyes, regaining my sight in time to see my son lift a coal hammer as high as he could, its broad steel head swept down. I turned away, and it struck me on the nose, which tore off and flew into the fire, where it settled, sizzling. Leota hit me on the head with the bucket so hard that I span and slapped onto my back. Andadam stepped forward and began striking again and again at my shins, my knees, my thighs. He worked up my body, breaking, shattering. He broke my ribs as if they were kindling. Blood sprayed hot and sour into my mouth. I felt pity for myself. I was not ready to die.
Testing this. Okay. Why so dark, Irish writers? darkness is a recurring theme in much of Irish literature. David's book is called Darker with the Lights On. Did I say that? I'm not sure I said that in the introduction. Kevin Barry has a collection of short stories called Dark Lies the Island. There's another collection, Room Little Darker by, yes, right. It is, yes, let me start by asking you all, you know, the title of our panel is Breaking Literary Ground, Ambitious Young Writers from Ireland. So I would like to ask you first, how old are you?
I just wanted to clarify that because in case you think all Irish people have some terrible wasting disease, I'm actually 50 years old. I think it's young in terms of our careers, in fact, because we're all relatively recently published. So I think that's where the young comes
short
from.
Short careers.
Yeah. So what was the...
Talk about... Ireland, how Ireland has shaped you as a writer or shaped your work, and that's wide open. Wherever we can go, we go from there is fine.
Okay. Well, first of all, in Ireland, it's dark pretty much all the time. That's why, you know, you wouldn't find an Irish writer who would refuse to come to this festival because we're further down south and the sunshine here. We're also thrilled to be here. I packed about 6 weeks ago, so I was really... really very excited about this. I had to defrost my bikini, but I'm not sure that I'll get a chance to use that this weekend. But the physical darkness that we experience in Ireland must have some impact on the way we write, because certainly there's a lot of cloud cover for a lot of the year. So, I mean, I do have a friend who moved to Ireland from Florida and got a terrible disease because he just... couldn't take the lack of sunshine. It was really bad. So we do live in the dark quite a lot of the time. But also, Ireland has a dark history and a dark past. I'm sure you're all aware of the famine, but also there's been societal abuses in church and state and politicians and corruption and police. And so I guess it permeates the mind. And, you know, at the moment we're having a referendum on abortion and abortion rights. So that is coming through a lot of modern writing at the moment as well. So I think all of that, you cannot be unaffected by it. You cannot be unaware of it. And I know Emer writes about sacrifice a lot in her book, so I'll let her tell you about that.
Well, I'm not sure about sacrifice, but I think Irish writers are so preoccupied with darkness because Irish society has been so preoccupied with pretending that it doesn't exist. I feel like there's been a big dancing around the idea, you know, because I think there's a big link between Irish literature and Russian literature, and that ability to delve into very hefty, very deep subjects. But the difference between the Russian character and the Irish character is, you know, the Russians see a big pit and they go, oh my God, there's the pit. And the Irish go, there's a pit over there, don't look over there. And I think Irish writers, that's kind of become the job of the Irish writer, is to go and go, oh shit, there is a pit. I'm going to have to look in the pit now. And there's bodies buried in it. And I think... you get a lot of that in Irish literature because, you know, I think we were all raised on the myth of the friendly, welcoming, lovely Irish and how much better they were than the English because you could always go up and chat to them in the pub and they would never look down on you. And I think there was a lot invested in that idea of the Irish being welcoming and being the opposite of what the old enemy was. But actually, I think Irish people are much harder to get to know. They have an approachability, but not necessarily a deep capacity for friendship. I think we are all kind of quite private in an odd way, that there's a point in for Irish people that's very hard to get beyond. And a lot of things become hidden behind that sort of national privacy.
Irish indirection.
Yeah. And so I think the literature, as it should, tries to get underneath all of that, to get beyond those things, to get to a more essential truth about the country and about who we are. Anyway, that's my tuppence worth.
There's a great poem by Patrick Kavanagh called Dark Ireland, and I think most Irish people hate Patrick Kavanagh because they have to read him at school, and then they have a lifelong loathing of his works, which is a bit of a shame because he's actually really good. But there's a poem called Dark Ireland. There's a line in it about dark paths turning inward awry, and it's got this great plodding rhythm. I read that first when I was a teenager, and I went, yes, I recognise that. You know, I recognised it in my family and my upbringing. I was, as you can probably tell from, you might be able to tell from my accent, I have an English accent, north of England accent. I was born in Dublin, but grew up on the other side, directly on the other side of the Irish Sea. So I look out to sea a lot. Someone told me recently that sea turns up a lot in my fiction. I think it probably does because of that. So there's this kind of silver, dark, muddy, sewage-smelling sea in between the two countries that hides a great deal, and so I look out on both of those. So I suppose that's part of the metaphorical landscape. But I think there are a lot of secrets and lies, or there have been in Irish life. You know, we had a civil war that was only my grandparents' generation. It's not that long ago. You know, a lot of people killed a lot of people. And nobody talks about it except in kind of very specifically defined historical terms. So you can talk about it as history, but you can't talk about it in terms of what someone's great uncle did, or somebody that you know, or who got to own that particular piece of land, or got to be a senator, or any of those things that you're not supposed to talk about. So not talking about something, not just indirection, but misdirection, is a very important part of Irish discourse. And writers, I think, Or the awkward squad. They you know, we poke into things and say, why are you looking at it this way? And they use the immense resources and the diversity of Hibernian English, for want of a better expression, to find the truth about our life. And some of those truths are universal, I think, as well. And it's one of the reasons why Irish writing is read so widely across the world, is because once you go through that process of going through the dark, you end up coming to somewhere that a lot of people recognize, no matter from, you know, where they originate.
Emer, I had the experience of being, I was in Ireland in the summer of 2015, and we were in a cottage in County Clare, and it was July, and I was building the fire, and there was a pile of newspaper, and I came upon a review of A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. And I tried to find this again because it was so striking. This reviewer was very angry with you for exposing dark secrets, specifically angry with your exposing Ireland's dark secrets to an English audience and reaffirming English ideas about the Irish people. Did you come? Did you have a lot of that in the reception, or I don't know what you want to do with that? But
well, it's always, you know, good to hear about a bad review.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, this writer was taking no issue with the literary merit of your work. Mm. It was, why are you telling our secrets?
Yes, now I remember that review. I think he was a sports writer who had an opportunity to get very annoyed with an Irish woman who dared to open her mouth and talk about things that might be annoying and embarrassing to he as an Irish male. Look how well the horses are running. What's she talking about? Shut up. No, I didn't, to be honest. And I remember that review because that was practically the only review that...
I tossed it in the fire.
I think... Good work. I think I was lucky because, you know, it took me a very long time to get A Girl's Half-Formed Thing published. But when it was finally published, and I was no longer young, it came out into a very receptive atmosphere. And I think in terms of what was going on in the literary culture in the UK and in Ireland at that time, where there was I think readers were tiring of being given the same old crap and were ready for something new. And publishers had been quite cynical and hadn't really been making any effort to bring readers new, interesting kind of writing, and had just been kind of pushing the social realism and saying that this was basically the end point of all literature and everything else that had gone before had led to this and this was it. And I think readers were really tired of that and were ready for something else. But also, I think in Ireland specifically, by the time that book came out, there had been so many fractures that people were much more willing, and women readers particularly, very keen to be talking about those kind of issues and openly and without that the muzzle of, don't you be airing the dirty laundry in front of the English. I mean, that's just exhausting bullshit, and that the time for all of that is so long gone. But it is, of course, another way to make women shut up and to not embarrass the nation by with their bodies and the terrible things that happen to them. And, you know, I think I was very unlucky and then I was very lucky. So that was, everything came out at the right time for me. I found a receptive audience. So your man, yeah, I think that put an end to his reviewing career, alas, for us all.
Good to know. I'm glad to know that. So let's hear about how each of you came to writing fiction, because you have all done other things and are in the world of publishing and the arts in other ways. So David, let's start with you.
I'm 52, so I've been taking my time, really. I've always written in one way or another. How I came to this point, I had children, and I started to write stories for them. And I'd make up stories, and then I started to write them down. And I had written stuff before, but I got a sense of returning to the possibility of telling stories, and I thought this was great. I was reading a book called The Happiness of Getting It Down Right, which is the letters between William Maxwell and Frank O'Connor, Michael O'Donovan, and which is a really wonderful book about an editorial relationship which becomes a friendship, and there's an enormous amount in it. And the two families, the Maxwell and the Donovan family, became quite close. And there was a story in one of those letters about William Maxwell writing a story every year as a Christmas present for his wife Elizabeth. And I really liked that idea, so I thought, I'll do the same. I was broke and couldn't afford a present anyway. So I wrote a story, and it just came straight out, and printed it out and wrapped a red ribbon around it and put it under the Christmas tree, and that was it. And my partner, my wife Melissa, read it and she said, "You know, this is actually really quite good." Yeah, well, no, she's a great, she's a very insightful and hard tackle reader. I would have heard otherwise if she didn't think it was any good. And so I felt really encouraged by that. And so I wrote another. So the first one was Hay. That was the Christmas present, which is the first one? No, it's the third one in the book. I don't even know my own thing. And then I wrote another one. And so I got in the habit of writing on the bus, basically, because that was the only time that I had. So almost all of this was written on the number 43 bus in London, going to and from work in small sort of bits. And then I started to send things out to magazines. And it was Irish magazines that picked them up. And it was usually someone that had some kind of poetry background that had an ear for what I was writing. So Declan Mead at The Singing Fly and Rebecca O'Connor at The Moth. And it was Kieran Carson at the Yellow, who's a really very good poet, at The Yellow Nib. And they all picked up stories and said really interesting things and really helped me develop and to think critically about what I was doing. And I just sort of carried on, really, and haven't stopped.
I came to writing sort of via the scenic route. I worked in theatre for a long time as a stage manager for about 15 years. So I was always kind of hovering closer and closer to the text. I worked as a stage manager, so I worked very closely with the text and the book and the script. So, you know, I got a good grounding in Ibsen and Beckett and Shakespeare and Chekhov and all the kind of world playwrights. And then I worked on a soap opera for 10 years, which was just hell. I'm not going to name it because it's still going. But after 30 years, I did 10 of them. It was, you know, my purgatory. But it's four half-hour episodes a week. So that's the equivalent of making a feature film every week, and it's relentless. It's a freight train that must keep on the rails. So, you know, after the 15th story of, you know, the long lost brother falling in love with his half sister, and yeah, I just found it really tedious, and I had to kind of get off that train. But so, in the meantime, while I was working on that show, I wrote a couple of short stories, and I wrote a TV drama for another broadcaster, and I wrote a 6-part animation series for other people. But all of this while I was doing my full-time job. But one of the short stories that I had submitted for the Francis McManus competition, it didn't win anything, but it was shortlisted. And the characters in that short story just wouldn't really leave me alone. I mean, they kept kind of knocking on my door at night saying, what about us? You know, you didn't tell them anything about us. So I kind of listened to those characters and developed that short story into Unraveling Oliver. So that's really how it came about. It was kind of long-winded. I was hovering ever closer and closer to actually writing a book. But television, and it wasn't all bad. I don't mean to badmouth it completely, but it's very much collaborative. You know, all kinds of people can ruin your writing when you're writing for television, be it a director or an actor can just do a really bad job and interpret your work really badly, or you might be unlucky enough to get a bad script editor. Not like Rachel O'Flanagan down here, who's one of the best script writers in Ireland, who, you know, is available for if anybody wants to come and talk to them about their books. But there's lots of collaboration, and I wanted something that was distinctly my own work. So it wasn't entirely because you get an editor, but I luckily got a good editor who helped me to make the book a lot better than it originally was. So that's how it came about.
Did writing for television help you write for fiction in some ways? I would think in some ways in terms of getting it down or...
Well, it in one specific way it did, because it was a soap opera, and the nature of soap opera is that you get your audience back the next day. That's the central thing. So my the way I wrote the book was I ended every chapter on a hook that stopped you putting the book down, I hope. So it did seem to work, because a lot of people have said to me that they read the book in one sitting or two sittings. So that's immensely gratifying. So, yeah, I do have something to thank that show for.
Well, again, I also started out in different area, which I think is also something worth talking about a little bit, that there are a lot of writers, particularly Irish writers, who kind of arrive into writing from a different angle, and that I think that does bring something new. It's not just people who've been taught how to write a novel in a particular way, writing novels in particular ways. It's people who find their way to that form through other means, and I think that can be kind of interesting. But I mean, I've been writing all the time since I was a child, and but then I decided that I wanted to be an actress, so that everyone could have a good look at me. And I went to drama school in London, and everyone did have a good look at me. It was great. But I think I was really interested. What I realised was that I was interested in the language and making language physical rather than the other way around. And that quite soon after I left drama school, I realised that I didn't really... One, I wasn't really a communal kind of person, which is not great if you want to be an actor. And two, that was what I was interested in, really, was language. And so to then justify having spent all this money to go to drama school, I spent several years doing nothing but temping. And I used to get up in the mornings about 5 a.m. and write for 2 hours before I'd go and answer phones and lick envelopes. And all of that was terrible. All absolute rubbish. But it was getting the muscles into working order, and it was teaching myself how to write. And then when I was 26, my husband got a job directing a play in Japan, and this very well paid. Probably wasn't that well paid, but it seemed like a lot of money to us at that time. And he said, okay, we're going to go to Japan. When we come back, whatever's left of this fee, that is your writing money. However long you can make that last, that's what you've got. And so that's how I wrote A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. And we managed to scrape it out for 6 months. And then I sent it out into the world, expecting the world, of course, to fall at my feet immediately. And everyone said, no, this is great, but I have no idea how to sell this, go away. And it was another 9 years before it was published.
I great acclaim. Immense acclaim.
Yeah, but it nearly killed me to get there, in fairness. Oh, yeah. Oh,
sure. I just wanted to pick up on that, because I also trained as an actress.
Yeah.
But I walk with a limp. I had a series of accidents, and I only write with my left hand. You know, I lost the use of my right hand, so I only type with my left hand which everybody thinks is very commendable, but I have to remind them that Shakespeare wrote with one hand and a feather. So, you know, really, it's not that great. But I did go to the Gage School of Acting, and I did some training there with a limp, with my, you know, with my dragging my leg, and kind of realizing afterwards that there aren't that many productions of The Glass Menagerie. And there really was only one part written in the English language for a girl with a limp. So I had to put those goals aside.
But I think it does bring something. And I think there are a lot of Irish writers who come particularly from a theatre background or a TV background or an acting. Yeah, exactly. And I think it really brings a fresh, more interesting idea about character. And I think that Irish writing is the one thing, whatever way we're writing in different forms and genres and whatever, characters are really, and voice is really important to all Irish writers. And that, I think that really feeds into that.
I'll just use this moment to tell, when I met Emer yesterday for the first time, but when I met her, I said, I felt as if I already knew her because I had listened to both of her novels, audiobook versions, which she herself reads, and I highly recommend those. I see some people nodding out in the audience. I think that, it's not, sometimes you hear that an author has done their own audiobook and you go, oh, and in this case, I think it's absolutely right because it, Emer's work, her prose is very challenging, and what better way to learn how to read it than to hear her read it herself? So a little
thank you
plug there.
I think my publisher would like me to add at this moment. It's not at all challenging. It's very easy.
Oh,
you should run out and buy many copies for all your friends and not concern yourselves with the language.
Absolutely. You should have both. You should have the print version and the audio version. We were sitting at breakfast before we got lost on our way across the street, and you all had started talking with one another about your works, and I had said that I would ask you to ask questions of one another. So I'm going to try that now, and we'll see how it goes, or offer comments to each other about each other's works. Emer and David, you were acquainted already, and you have you are featured prominently on the cover of his book. Maybe. And David, you were talking.
Yes, so I knew David because he had written an article about Irish Books of the Dark, in which he had included A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, and introduced me to a book called In Night City by Dorothy Nelson, which was very odd for me because when I read it, read to me like the predecessor of A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. I mean, it was really odd to read something and think, oh, wow, shit, I didn't invent that. That's already been done. But it was, so that's how we sort of met. And then we ended up, we were living in the same city in the east of England. And I read David's book and I was, again, because I'm quite obsessed with modernism, it struck me that this was a new strand that you were pulling at. And so could you say a little bit maybe about your relationship to modernism?
Okay. It's the modernism question. To me, modernism is not a genre to me. It's a way of approaching reality or reality through language, and what I don't like is the idea of a certain that it's a set of skills to learn or a set of techniques, and there's a certain amount of ventriloquism involved. So you basically, you know, you stick your hand up Sam's back and then you do your Beckett-y thing, That to me is not what modernism is. There are versions of that, but that's kind of, like I say, it's ventriloquism. What appeals to me about modernism is that it's a moment where you, with the writer and the reader, also gets a return to the originary moment of the emergence of literature as we know it in English. There's a great book by J. Paul Hunter called Before the Novel, and what he did in that's from the 1970s, and he tracks through all of the texts that existed before the novel. So they could be broadsheets, they could be ballads, they could be travel literature, they could be a forgotten genre called the Wonder Book, which I'm quite interested in. And there's lots and lots of other different kinds of genres, some of which are still around, some of which aren't. And what happened was that the novel emerged as the kind of omniphage. You know, it's the mode in which that ate everything, that could encompass everything. You know, in the way that, Don Quixote does that, it's got the whole world in it, and more. It's got places that aren't the world in it also, like Tristram Shandy. And then, you know, there are non-Western sort of precursors to that as well, like The Tale of Genji, which is just a staggering book, which has just about everything in it, especially death, which I love. It's great. It's a journey to death, and then to the other side of it. So for me, modernism is about repositioning yourself as a writer and a reader in relation to all of that possibility. So it and doing that in language, and that means that you are sort of terrifyingly alone with the blank page and the possibility and your internal cadences, but also that you have the company of absolutely everybody who's ever written, and also the ghost of everybody who could have but didn't. So I'm probably talking too much about this, but yeah. So I'm obsessed with that, a small M modernism as a kind of possibility of doing things that nobody else does, rather than just sort of doing a knock off the waves. You know, the waves has already been done. And it's amazing, and it's always different every time you step into it. And that is what that also appeals to me about modernism. You can go back to Ema's first book again and again and again, and it's actually different every time you step into it. And that, if anything is modernism, then that's modernism.
That's good. And David, hold on to the microphone. Oh. I was going to ask you were making comments about, you were talking about Unraveling Oliver.
Oh yeah.
And so I wondered if you might sort of.
Yeah, I mean, there is that. The whole thing of attempt again, that propulsive motion by having the hook at the end totally works. You won't be able to stop reading it. It's really staggering. But one of the things that I really really liked about Unraveling Oliver is the there will be a question in this. is the unreliability, and you get of almost each narrator. So you get these successive kind of tellings of the story in layers, in unraveling layers, onion layers, as you go through, and you get a story in the shape of a story through that, and you get different stories, and there's lots of movement against the narrative, which is a very risky thing to do in a supposed thriller genre. How did you come to take such a kind of massive risk?
Well, I took my lead, I guess, from Shakespeare. You know, I'm not comparing myself to Shakespeare for a second, but you know, the opening has to be impactful. And I remember a touring Shakespeare company coming to my school when I was about 14 and studying Macbeth, and them discussing with us the opening scene of The Witches on the Heath and predicting what was going to happen. And I thought, okay, so we actually know what's going to happen. It's all predicted, it's all laid out there, so now we just got to play it out. So I decided to put the assault and the whodunit up front, so we know. I mean, from my reading, you know who's done it, and the rest of the book is to unravel why he has done it, and also to hear from the people in this couple's lives who think that they know them really well, who think that they know them both really well, and to explore from them what aspects of their lives they have showed to these characters, and I'm fascinated by nature and nurture and the way, you know, you think you know your mother really well. There are things about your mother that you will never know, that she will never tell you. You think you know your husband really well. There are things, you know, my husband's best friend died a couple of years ago, and I remember thinking that I will never know what his loss is like, because this friend was somebody he knew in college before I knew him. So I will never understand his loss entirely. And I think that's true of everybody in our lives, no matter how close we are to them, that we never know them entirely. So that's what I wanted to explore in the book, was the manner of revealing characters to themselves and to each other. So now I have a question for you, Emer. I was fascinated by sort of, well, I don't know whether you were comfortable with the word experimental when it comes to Girls Have Form thing, but it seemed to me that it was an extremely original way of doing a book. Like Solar Bones by Mike McCormick, which came out a couple of years afterwards, did more or less the same thing without punctuation. But yours was a stream of consciousness, backwards and forwards, with multiple characters, brilliantly evoking all of these different aspects of the story. And then I saw a stage adaptation of it. And I'm just wondering, how did you perceive the stage adaptation compared to the book? I mean, did you hand it over, or did you do a lot of that adaptation yourself?
That was an odd experience, because I remember at the time Annie Ryan, who directed the show, approached me. She asked if I would do the adaptation, and I was in the middle of finishing The Lesser Bohemians, so I said, I don't have time. But she had done other literary adaptations for the stage, so we agreed that she would do it, and we basically agreed that she could do an abridgment rather than adaptation. She was allowed to cut down the original text, but not to add or to change. And she set it as a one-woman play, that thing which everyone loves to go to, of course. but I did really struggle with it, because the purpose of the book is that the girl is never an object, that she is never seen from the outside. There is no description of what she looks like. Everything that the reader knows about her, they know from her internal life. The point of the book, the point of the prose, is to place the reader inside her body, so that what is happening to her happens to them. And so she's never seen. Her height, weight, hair colour, eye colour, none of this is ever described. And so to suddenly put her on the stage, it was to make her an object. And I was very concerned about that, especially because of a lot of the sexual nature of the material. I was very anxious about putting a young woman on stage and that becoming sexualized in a way that didn't chime with what the book was about. So I said, no, at first, and then Annie was very persuasive, so and I was weak. So I said, okay, well, let's go. And she, I think happily for all of us, she cast absolutely the right actress in Aoife Duffin, who was extraordinary. I mean, really, really, and nearly killed herself doing that. And she, you know, she did it for 6 weeks in Edinburgh. She did it for a month in London. She took it to New York. So she really went through it with that part.
Did you see it before it was before a live audience, or did you see it? How was that for you, seeing it?
No, well, the first I saw of it was the first week of rehearsal in Dublin. And I had just finished recording the audiobook. So I had a very, very particular idea in my head of how the language should sound. And so I arrived into rehearsal ready to be, you know, offended and enraged by everything. So that was obviously a great atmosphere for all of them. And so we sat down to do the read-through, and within 10 minutes of Aoife starting, I thought, that's fine. That's going to be fine. And she read it completely differently to how I did it, but she understood it, and I could tell that she understood, and that she had to make her own, and that I had to back off and let her do that for it to work. And she did. She did it really, really beautifully. And so then I saw it. I saw it quite a few times. I saw it when it opened in Dublin. I saw it in Edinburgh and again in London and in New York. And it was interesting to watch how that performance grew and changed. And that by the time she got to New York, you could see that she was just getting a bit broken around the edges with it, that it was just becoming too much. And I think they had hoped that she would tour it some more afterwards, and she just said, I can't. And everyone thought, yeah, that's just, you've really done enough. You've really... but she was fantastic, and I think she remains, for a lot of people, completely identified with the book and with that part, and I'm very happy for that to be the case. I think she was fantastic.
What is everyone working on now?
To respond to something Emer was saying, because Emer explores sexuality very bravely in her book, and I can't write about sex in my books, and I think it's because both my parents are alive, and if I write about it, they'll know that I've done it. So, so I try really hard to kind of stay away from them. So, like, I have sort of amateur, immature fumblings in my books, but I can't go there with the sex. I just... It's so Irish. It's so pathetic. the guilt. But I am working on I'm 10,000 words into my fourth novel, which is about three brothers, and they're all equally horrible in different ways. Yeah.
I've more or less finished another book of short stories. Guys, it's like ordering. I was saying this the other night. It's like going to a pizza restaurant, ordering a round of dough balls, and then ordering another round of dough balls. No, nobody really wanted the first one. So I got a second round of dough balls in the oven, and there's some garlic butter to go with that. And it's different. It's very different from the first one. Not that different. It's quite different from the first in that each story is set in an identifiable place, whereas the Dark with the Lights On is deliberately decontextualized. It's very strongly got place in it, but it's stories in seven cities that I've lived in or familiar with, including Norwich. Yeah. The two Norwich stories are in a new magazine called Egress. I think they'd probably want me to plug it, which you should get because it's got a new story by Diane Williams in it, which will make your hair fall out. And it's got Ellie Williams and it's got lots of other great stuff in it. But it's got two stories by me set in Norwich, both featuring the work of Sir Thomas Browne. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a real crowd pleaser. Anyway, so there's that. And I'm writing a novel called The Folds, which is partly about it's about art and about life, and it tells the story of a woman through her engagement with works of art. It's probably better than that sounds, but it's And it will have a happy ending, which is unusual for me. All of this dark stuff. But I'm also writing something else, which is indescribable, really. It's more of an art thing, really, which is also terrible. I really shouldn't be doing it. Twenty-five years ago, I was walking down Exmouth Market in Clerkenwell in London. This is before it was gentrified, when it was still sort of vaguely had its old Italian kind of heritage. And there was a bookshop there, which was actually a front for a fence, as in somebody that received stolen goods for money. So it wasn't a real bookshop, but it was also coincidentally he had really good taste for a fence, a literary taste. And in the window, they had a full set of the fantasy Viennese journal that Karl Kraus edited, called Die Fackel. And I just thought, what's this doing here? So I went in and I had a chat, and he said, "Oh, I got this complete set from a um, from a guy who's just died, and he lived in a flat on his own in Wembley, which is, you know, horrible West London. And it was a small apartment that was packed with books, many of them in German. He was a Viennese emigre, had fled the Nazis, and so he had this extraordinary thing. That has sort of kind of haunted me for years, this idea of a life in books, in a space. So I'm not telling his story because it's not mine to tell, but what I'm going to do is I'm writing 2,000 sentences, one from each book, in the library of someone that has recently deceased. And there'll be some kind of framing narrative over the top, but I'm sort of about 400 sentences into writing this 2,000, which, you know, when my agency said, she's just going to go, and I'm writing more short stories as I go along, as I can't seem to stop. It's like a compulsion. So sorry about that.
My second novel, Lesser Bohemians, is the first of a trilogy. I haven't said much about that book, but come to my later event. I'll talk all about that and all the shagging in that book. But I'm starting work on the second part of that. And also I'm... Same characters, yeah. And this year I'm creative fellow at the Beckett Research Centre at the University of Reading, where Beckett's archive is held. And so as the part of that, I have to spend 15 days in the archive over the course of the academic year and then easily enough come up with a new work based on something that I've seen in Beckett's archive. So I'm frantically trying to do that as the summer approaches. So that's what I'm doing.
Sounds great. Yes. I'm going to give the audience a chance to ask questions. But before that, just wanted to let you know where you can hear these writers doing their second. Emer just said you're going to be right here at 1:30 doing an interview. You will be interviewed by Sylvia Brownrigg, right? And Liz, your second event is
3:45, I think. It's 3:15. Thank you. Moderated by Brian Cliff with crime writer's Icelandic Irsa Sigurdardóttir. I'm probably mispronouncing that. And Kaaro Himalainen, Finnish writer. So that's going to be really fun because I'm going to spend the first, you know, half an hour trying to get to grips with their names. But it's really about the nature of evil and deconstructing evil. So that should be lots of fun.
And David, you have another event.
Yeah, there's a short story festival which will be absolutely rammed. Short story thing with is it Matsubara Ono and Gunhild Oyehuga, Japanese and Swedish. Norwegian, yes, Norwegian, short story writer, both of whom are brilliant, and it's Michael Holtman, I think, who's going to be chairing it. So I don't know what we're going to talk about, but we're going to be talking about short stories and comparing notes. So.
Okay, so if people would like to ask questions, you want them to come down to the microphone at the front of the room. Please do. I know people are interested in talking with our writers, so.
Feel free to hold this too if you need to.
Okay, all seriousness aside for a minute. In my experience of reading Irish fiction, it seems to me sometimes I come across one sentence where it's both very painful and very funny at the same time. I don't know if that's other people's experience. When I go to the library, I'm going to the new authors section where I don't know anybody. And I can't find anything of someone I know, so I look for authors with an Irish-sounding name or a Jewish-sounding name. Partly because I feel like those are the best storytellers, but also because of this darkness and light at the same very moment. Can you comment on that? Any of you?
I think tragedy and comedy, you know, they say tragedy plus time equals comedy. I think it's much quicker. I don't think you don't need the time. I think tragedy can be hilarious. You know, you just got to ask an Irish person about the last funeral they've been to, and you'll be rolling in the aisles because they are invariably funny. And I think.
And weddings the opposite.
Yeah. Weddings, oh my God, the trauma of going to a wedding is just, it's terrible. But I do think we're attuned to, maybe it's because of all the darkness that we, you know, as a country that was conquered and colonized and impoverished and starved and then abused and we had to find our laughs where we could find them. And and it was a way of overcoming that darkness. So yeah, we're pretty funny.
Yeah, the humor is kind of impossible to avoid. It just unless you're so ho-faced, there is a streak in Irish life of complete up yourself. Seriousness, which has in which the sense of humour has completely died, and there's nothing funnier than that actually in Irish life. That kind of po-faced self-regard, but for the rest of us, which is the majority, almost everything is funny. Almost everything is funny. I remember hearing that was Howard Jacobson, who grew up in Manchester in the 50s. Talking about, and he went, you know, his went to a school which is predominantly Jewish, and him talking about how the boys would compete to tell the worst Holocaust jokes, and he did tell a joke which I'm not going to repeat because it's his joke and I can't tell that, and it was just cripplingly funny, and he said, what else were we going to do, really? What else were we going to do? Almost everybody that he knew had family who'd lost, you know, 2/3, 3/4, you know, 90% of their family that had been in Europe. So, that competition to be the funniest about it, I just really admired. I thought that's really amazing, kind of, you know, it's the power of the human spirit and the persistence, and we're here. You know, we survived. Screw you, which I really liked, and I think there's an element of that in Irish humour. There's a propulsion and there's an edge to it. It's not a kind of cosy humour.
Yeah, I mean, I can't add much more to that. I think the Irish, but many other people as well, have to find a sort of an element of the ridiculous. That makes the futility of all life acceptable. Otherwise, why would you bother to make it through to the end? I think that's part of. I think maybe heightened in Irish life, a heightened sense of the ridiculous, which is also comes out of that post-colonial breaking of authority. That's always very important of any kind of authority, and that po-faced authority particularly. I think that's what most humor comes from.
Do we have any other questions from our audience? If not, I actually have a request, and it's for David. You decided, I guess, not to read from your, how to read picture books? But that... the part where the old man gives his theory of the afterlife?
That's the critical reading.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, it is. Sorry. I'm so sorry. I got them mixed up. But would you read...
Earl in the other one,
right.
Doesn't it?
That's right. would you read just that paragraph? Because I think it's so appropriate for the book festival. I've never done that of sort of like asking a writer to read a very specific paragraph in their work, but I think when you hear it, you'll know why I am asking for that. Yeah, we have another question. Fantastic. We can ask another question. I didn't realize that we had more people. I didn't. Okay, go ahead. Questions.
So my question, in addition to your youthful selves, what would you recommend to somebody? Who are you reading right now? What other Irish authors are you really reading and enjoying right now that you would recommend to your friends?
Well, I, unfortunately, for my mental health, am reading an awful lot of Beckett at the moment. I think there are a lot of very interesting Irish writers. I mean, there's a lot. People are talking about this great Irish Renaissance at the moment. I think June Caldwell is absolutely a writer that everyone should be reading. And, of course, a person I love always is Kevin Barry.
Yeah, I'd definitely say those two, but also Joan O'Ryan, Louise O'Neill, and Kit Duvall are all Irish writers really worth exploring.
Yeah, I'd agree with all of that. And there is a Belfast writer called Wendy Erskine who's got a first collection of short stories coming out in Ireland, I think, later this year, Three Stinging Fly. And I've read a couple of hers in journals, and there's one online, actually, on the Irish Times at the moment. And she's really, really interesting and really different. But, you know, you throw a rock in the air in Ireland and you'll hit a writer, which is why there are so many people throwing rocks in the air.
Could you say those names one more time? A little slower.
Kevin Barry, June Caldwell, Kit Duvall, who else did we say? Donald Ryan, Louise O'Neill. Who else are you saying?
Wendy Erskine.
Yeah. Did you get all those?
Yeah.
You can come afterwards.
Come to me afterwards. Yeah.
Hi. Ooh, hot gun. I don't have a gun. I'm sorry. I think that a lot of people in the States feel this comfort about Irish literature in that it's oppression, but here in the States, it's an oppression that looks very different from the way Americans oppress, I guess. And so I guess I was wondering, particularly since Ireland is a multicultural country now, and two of you are living in a nation affected by Brexit, I mean, what would you like to say to your American audiences to kind of put us straight?
Impeach.
I mean, you got the right crowd here, but...
And I would add to that, repeal the eighth, if you know what that is. That's our moment. That's got to happen. I'll be heartbroken if that doesn't happen.
Does everyone know that?
No. Okay. The Irish Constitution has an Eighth Amendment to it, which basically makes it impossible to legislate for women's reproductive freedom, their bodily autonomy. It's impossible to legislate for, and it's not just abortion, but it does include that. And so in order for the possibility of the law changing, we have to have a referendum and to repeal the amendment in the Constitution. And then the various political parties have promised that they will bring forward legislation. But it then makes it possible for the democratic process to be followed, to change the law. And it's something that... I feel, and lots of people, family, friends, feel incredibly strongly about. And this is really stupid thing, which makes me really cross. Men who, Irishmen who apparently favour repeal, that are saying they think it's a women's issue and then planning not to go out and vote. It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I think, you know, everybody has a responsibility of, who has a vote, to go out and vote. And, you know, and I think that about, you know, the legislative process, whether it's here or in Britain or in Ireland, you vote for the least worst. You don't vote. You don't not vote. If you've got major problems with, you know, your choice of party, you vote for the least worst because what you get is the worst. If you don't exercise that. So yeah, repeal the 8th.
Thank you. Hello. I want to ask about where you draw inspiration from coming from Ireland, since it's a very mystical place to people in America. So, you know, is it more of the Irish people, the history, or like the land itself?
To be honest, I don't really think about Ireland very much. That's not something that I draw inspiration from. I think that is just something that comes through because that's where I'm from. For me, when I sit down to write, I don't think, right now, Irish woman, what have you got to say today? For me, also, I'm not someone who really works off inspiration. I work off work. And so I just sit down and I start. And the way I wrote both of the first drafts of both of my novels was every day I wrote 1,000 words. And I didn't get up from the desk until I had written 1,000 words. And a lot of those words were rubbish, absolute rubbish. But the next day I would get up, I would read the 1,000 words. I would usually cut about 850 words and start again from the most interesting sentence. And that's how I, so it's not, for me, it's not about inspiration. It's just work, work, work. And if you keep pushing, eventually something will come through.
We should probably let our other questions ask their questions. Mine is related, which is, what do you do to ignite your creativity? And also, in your waking hours, but also, do you dream? You know, as fiction writers, do you find you get answers as you sleep as well? I'm curious about that.
I'm happy if I just get to sleep. Yeah, no. I read a lot, but that isn't necessarily where the work comes from. And there's a tendency for critics to think that books are made of other books, and that's understandable. And I see that. And I am a book maniac. You know, I've been in the book trade nearly 30 years as a bookseller and publisher. So that is me. But that's not really necessarily where the writing comes from. When you sit there with the blank page or the blank screen, it comes from what everything that's in the body. So for me, it's a very emotionally driven process, and it's about, you know, it sort of has a kind of rhythmic and sort of, if I can't catch the rhythm, the cadence of what I'm doing, then nothing happens at all. So it becomes sort of, the initial writing is sort of sub-intellectual. It may even be sub-intellectual when it's finished. But certainly the writing process is very sort of bodily and visceral.
Many years ago when I worked on the soap opera, I was in the writer's room and we were talking about a character who had just murdered another character. And I was saying, you know, quite strongly, I said, he must be in the horrors. I said, you know, guys, like when you wake up from a nightmare in which you've murdered somebody, you know how awful it feels. And everybody looked at me. And that was that was the first time I realized that not everybody dreamt about murdering people. So, but funny enough, since I started writing about murdering people, I don't have those dreams anymore. So I think that's kind of lucky, because maybe if I hadn't been writing about them, I'd probably be murdering people. So I got it out.
Can we do one more question?
Hi, I'm a student at UC Berkeley, and yesterday was our last day of classes, and the last book on our syllabus for my English class called Contemporary English and Irish Literature was A Girl's a Half-Worm Thing. So I was literally talking about it in school yesterday with my classmate over there. So this is a question for all three of you. I was just wondering, if you had to choose a work of yours, like a short story, a novel, or whatever, to be taught in an academic or specifically university setting, which one would it be and why?
For me, it would be The Lesser Bohemians. And I'll tell you for why. I think I think, you know, I'm very fond of A Girl as a Half-Form Thing, but I wrote it when I was 27 and with all the kind of nihilistic fury that you write with when you're 27. But I wrote Lesser Bohemians over 9 years. So, and I was in my, you know, I was 40 by the time it was published. And it is, for me, it's not only is the book itself about the life after trauma, whereas Girl is very much about the moment of trauma, Lesser Bohemians is about survival and how you live after that moment. And as a work, formally, it is less neat than A Girl as a Half-Form Thing. It is, there's a lot more going on there, but it's also, I think, a more humane book and a much more complex book. And although at the outset, the setup is much more reader-friendly and is much less, seems less demanding of the reader, I think it's a more complex work, so I plumb for that one.
I've only written three, so I would go for the first one because Unraveling Oliver explores Irish society at a particular time of the 70s and 80s and 90s, and it explores all kinds of issues to do with class, racism, the influence of the church, the double standards of society, the kind of the importance of appearances in society and having to look the part and pass yourself off as something that you're not. And it really exposes the hypocrisy in Ireland. But it also shows you a kind of a beautiful side of Ireland as well, I think. So I choose that one.
It's available in the lobby, Unraveling Oliver.
Yeah, it's an incredibly vivid portrait of a time and a place. I've only got the one book, so, you know. That's your choice. But you don't, if you don't want to read the whole thing, I mean, the one from this book, I'd probably say would be Golding, which is a story. It's probably the most difficult one. Would you say that, Adam? In that it's a story of transformation, and the title is Golding, partly from the physical image, but also from Arthur Golding, who was the first. He was Shakespeare's Ovid. He's a person that translated Ovid, and it's full of problems. But it's from a reading of that, reading about in that early modern English. Pre-Shakespeare, incredibly robust and powerful and beautiful and strange and book of transformations. I wrote my own sort of story of transformations, which is transformation, from trauma, from shifting between different types of personhood, different types of gender and non. And so the story, that story flows in a particular way, and was a very important story for me. It was the one I'd spent longest time putting together, because the book is very carefully patterned, he said. And that was the most important piece. But there's another story called Return, which isn't in this book, which could have been, but the literary magazine, The Stinging Fly, which had such an important influence on Irish literature in the last 20 years, has just published a 20-year anniversary anthology edited by Sarah Gilmartin and Declan Mead, just called Stinging Fly Stories. You can't get it here, but you could order it from them. They'd be very grateful if you would do that. And that has got that's got stories in there by myself, by Keith Ridgway, by Kevin Barry, June Caldwell. Anyway, it's a really great anthology. It's got 40 stories in it. There's a story in there called Return by Me, which is one of my favorite of my own stories, which you're not really supposed to do, have favorites of your own stories. But that's also about memory, and it's also about story. It was a real breakthrough for me when I was writing it. and is full of a lot of feeling that I think that would is kind of representative of what the kind of thing I write.
All right. Well, we've come to the end of our hour and 15 minutes. Our writers will be in the lobby right outside with books available for sale and signature. Thank you so much for joining us.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.